The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to another podcast. And this week we're in obstreperous form. We're going to be quarrelling with Miss Peacher, the teacher, about whether the essay must always be written according to rule. And we've been enlisting your support for our case that, on the contrary, it is a most delightfully unruly form.
When I visit a new bookstore, I demand cleanliness, computer monitors, and rigorous alphabetization. When I visit a second-hand bookstore, I prefer indifferent housekeeping, sleeping cats, and sufficient organisational chaos to fuel my fantasies of stumbling on, say, a copy of Poe's Tamerlane. Anne Faderman.
And we'll also take up the cudgels on behalf of Poetry in Translation, taking as our battlefield the legacy of the Bengali master Rabindranath Tagore.
At middle age, I came to this dry plain, where shadowy villages make a line of bulging green. Another river is my neighbour here, unglamorous, ordinary Kopai. Her name is not Aryan, but from the sing-song language of Santhal, she knows all her villages.
But first to this week's breaking news. At 8 a.m. on Wednesday, it was announced from Sydney that Philip Roth had won the International Man Booker Prize. At all of 8:20 a.m, it emerged that one of the three judges, Carmen Khalil, had condemned the decision in robust terms and resigned her post. Hundreds of readers have written in with their views since the story went up. With me here in the studio to summarise their opinions and offer a few of her own is our website books editor, Sarah Crown. Sarah, first, tell us what Carmen actually said about him.
OK, well, it's fair to say that she really didn't pull her punches. The quote that we have from her in the story is, "He goes on and on and on about the same subject in almost every single book. It's as though he's sitting on your face and you can't breathe," which is really...
Ouch, you wouldn't want Philip Roth sitting on your face particularly, would you?
Not so much. No.
So what did our web users think? Was it fairly even, or were people rushing to his defence?
I'd say it was probably representative of the way the population at large feels about him. It was probably about a 50-50 split, I think. People were either rushing to his defence, as you say, or rushing to condemn him in the manner of Carmen Khalil.
And I think you and I have a bit of a 50-50 split over this one, don't we? Because I mean, I do love a lot of his books, but I do think that he does write the same story again and again. And I'm always slightly perplexed that it's defended in his case when women writers write the same story, they're condemned for doing so.
It's so interesting because I don't think that at all in any way. And I'd even take issue with the idea that he writes the same story again and again. What he does is he has recurring themes and characters. But if you look at the great trio of his late great flowering in the 1990s through to 2000, which was American Pastoral, I Married a Communist and The Human Stain. And although there is a similarity in the books in terms of tone, in that they're all fired with this huge amount of drive and passion and muscularity, in terms of subject matter, they are extremely different. You know, we've got sort of the Vietnam War in the first one. I Married a Communist, the title says it all. And of course, anyone who's read the book and knows a bit about Roth realises that it's a fairly autobiographical study of his marriage and the disintegration of his marriage to Claire Bloom. And then the final book is set in academia and involves an inadvertent race row. And, you know, you can't really say that that's repeating those. Although they're all set in the same American, very American setting, They really range, I think.
Well, let's end this little discussion by dramatising the two most acute comments replying to each other on our website. And I'm going to start because I'm going to take the anti-line. Okay. I'm going to speak for Sunburst, who wrote, "Coetzee understands the depths of the human soul, while Roth understands Weequahic, New Jersey."
To which Kleistfile replies, "Of course, Weequahic is just as good a place to plumb the depths of the human soul as anywhere. Graham Greene wrote somewhere of George Eliot that what she wrote made the parochial universal. The same is true of Roth." And I'd say I couldn't have put it better myself.
Well, no doubt this conversation will continue, and you can read Carmen Khalil's full explanation in this weekend's Guardian Review. So now to essays. The launch of a new publisher dedicated to the essay has brought new life to an old genre, which was dismissed as far back as the 16th century as a few loose paragraphs and that's all by the playwright Ben Jonson. Notting Hill Editions launched last week with 7 volumes from thinkers ranging from the 18th century poet Samuel Rogers to the 21st century one, Lavinia Greenlaw, from the French thinkers Georges Perec and Roland Barthes to an English one, Jonathan Keats. In a blog to celebrate the launch, Notting Hill editor Lucasta Miller posed the question, what is an essay? For most people, she continued, the word conjures up memories of the things you were forced to write at school by people like Miss Peacher the teacher in Dickens' Our Mutual Friend, whose essays were always according to rule. Well, Lucasta's with me now to answer her own question. Well, why don't you start by answering your own question? What is an essay?
What is an essay? Well, in fact, I was going to pick up on what you said about Ben Jonson, who dismissing mere essayists, a few loose sentences and that's all. I think possibly Ben Jonson was rather jealous of the fact that his sort of near contemporaries, Montaigne and Francis Bacon, had actually succeeded rather well in turning the essay into a phenomenal genre. And in fact, when it comes to defining the essay, the thing that fascinates me most is that I can't think of another literary genre whose origins can really be traced to a single individual that was actually the invention of one man, Montaigne. And I think if we try and translate what he meant by essay, I think the best synonym we can come up with in modern English is experiment. And the thing about the essay is that it's almost impossible to define because it is such an experimental genre. I mean, you could say it meant prose with a voice. That's one definition I quite like. It could almost be any form of experimental prose. But then again, as soon as you try to define the essay as prose, you think of, for example, Pope's Essay on Criticism or Pope's Essay on Man. They are both poems.
Are they essays, though? Or is that just a sort of a joke by Pope that they're essays?
No, I think the word essay means literally a trial, an attempt. It's an idea of testing out your ideas. The idea, perhaps, that we mainly have of an essay today probably comes from the sort of Edwardian idea of the essay. I mean, certainly when I was at university in the 80s, which was the sort of age of theory and the death of the author, to me the idea of the essayist would have conjured up a sort of tweedy, conservative, sort of white male Edwardian writing boring stuff for that contemptible creature, the common reader. And yet, the thing about the essay is that throughout its history, whenever it's been absorbed into the mainstream, it sort of tends to sort of wither and die. And then, amazingly, it's reborn on the margins. It's a real outsider genre that can't really sustain being in the mainstream.
And do you think that they still exist? Are there good essays being written and who are writing them?
Yes, absolutely. Among the works that we're bringing out with Notting Hill Editions, the ones that most conform to the standard idea of the essay are probably Jonathan Keats's essay, The Portable Paradise, which is about the history of the travel guide. It's funny, it's poignant, and it begins in the first person. And I think that what makes it essayistic is that Jonathan could have written an academic monograph on the history of the travel guide. But his inspiration to write about it came from his personal passion for these books that he has collected himself and his personal engagement with them. So you get his scholarly research, but you also get his personal voice.
How long is that essay?
It's about 100 pages, but an essay can be almost anything.
Can it be book length?
Locke's essay concerning human understanding is 600 pages long. Some of Francis Bacon's essays are a page or a page and a half. That's the other thing with the essay. There are no rules.
I'm going to just challenge you on the history. On the history a bit, and this is actually coming from our correspondence on Twitter and also on the website. RO42 says, I always saw Pliny's letters as essay-like, as well as the sections of Caesar's memoirs, especially when Caesar meanders around Gallic traditions, getting them spectacularly wrong.
That's a very good point, and actually Francis Bacon said of essays, the word is new, but the thing is old. Of course, people had written in that sort of way occasionally before, but nobody had defined it as a genre in the way that Montaigne did.
Are they collections or are they single essays?
Georges Perec's Thoughts of Sorts is a sort of slightly sort of off-the-wall French whimsical meditation on the human need for classification. And you could really say it was a collection of tiny mini essays all approaching this idea from different angles. Jonathan Keats's one I've mentioned is continuous prose of around 100 pages. Richard Sennett's The Foreigner has two essays in it.
You mentioned Perec, and yes. I was interested that two of the seven are French.
Yes. Well, we were just incredibly lucky that we have the first UK publication of both of these texts, which have never been published in the UK before. The Roland Barthes is a particularly interesting book. It is not an essay in the strict sense, in that it was written as a private journal. It's called Morning Diary. It was written by Barthes after his mother died, and in it he's describing the experience of bereavement. Montaigne's idea of the essay was really, well, I think Emerson called it man thinking. It's about watching yourself think. And what this Morning Diary does, it, in spite of itself, becomes an essay on bereavement because it shows the author watching himself thinking, in this case, grieving.
One of those essay enthusiasts who chipped into the discussion on Twitter was the Scottish writer Ian Finlayson. He's a biographer of Boswell, among others. So I put to him one of our Twitter comments from Horace Manu that Boswell's Life of Johnson is a series of essays that are much better, actually, than Johnson himself.
Yes, I think when you come to think about what an essay is, you can... it's less easy to define it than to defend it. You know, you can take something out of Boswell, let's say, and say, oh, now, look at that lovely little essay. It might not have been intended as an essay, but it might just exist in the essay form. And you can find those in books. You can take anything out of a book, a non-fiction book, because an essay is non-fiction. An essay is, as Michael Holroyd said, is the non-fiction equivalent of a short story. And then you think, well, what's a short story? And the same way, how do you define an essay? The really dull definition is a composition, usually in prose, which may be of only a few hundred words or up to book length, and which discusses formally or informally a topic or a variety of topics.
Let's just go back into the history of it. The most common school of thought seems to be that it began with Montaigne.
There are lots of people before that who wrote essays without knowing they were essays, if you see what I mean. Going right back as far as Marcus Aurelius. I just have conveniently to hand. Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. I turn to book five. I'm just going to read the introduction and see if you think this is a really good start to an essay, and I want you to give me a title for it. Okay. At dawn, when you have trouble getting out of bed, tell yourself, I have to go to work as a human being. What do I have to complain of if I'm going to do what I was born for, the things that I was brought into the world to do, or is this what I was created for, to huddle under the blankets and stay warm? Now, the title of that might be... On Getting Out of Bed, you know. And it's wonderful. And then what he does as well is the classical thing for an essay. He sets up a tension, something to be discussed, an either or an or, you know, a pro or a con. Will I stay here? Will I get up? Will I huddle under the blankets and stay warm? And this is the point from which the essay proceeds. He gives himself something to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mickey McCode wrote in that nobody is going to dispute Montaigne as the father of the modern essay, but discursive non-fictional prose has been a stalwart of literature from time immemorial, as you say. Yeah. He says the Buddhists in Korea and Japan were writing essays thousands of years ago, and much of the Bible is essayistic in its moral reach and teaching, just as the Quran and Torah and other sacred texts are too. Is that just stretching the definition too much?
I don't know. I haven't read this stuff, but if he thinks it's an essay, then it probably is. You know, if it conforms with what he reads as an essay, and if it confronts a topic or a subject, a theme, an object even, and it runs with it, explores it, then in no matter how many words, an essay can be, as we said earlier, 500 words, and less than that, it can be novella length, like De Quincey on murder, considered as one of the fine arts, you know, which is usually published as a little book. It hasn't changed much. I like to ask the listeners and tweeters, actually, is there such a thing as a postmodern essay?
Somebody called Pilithgo said, yes? I suspect that there are more essays than ever being written. They are mostly referred to as blogs. Me not. One question I don't think we've yet answered is where essays and newspaper columns overlap. It was the essayist, or should that be columnist, Ian Jack, who set off a good discussion on our website for the last week over whether you can really translate poetry. He was marking the 150th anniversary of the birth of the Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore with a moan that not enough people know about the Nobel Prize winner. Ian thinks there's a reason for that. Is his poetry any good, he asked. For anyone who can't read Bengali, he answered, the answer is, I don't know, because no translation according to Bengalis lives up to the job. Well, Alice Oswald wasn't having any of that, was she, Sarah?
Certainly not, no. She is, as I'm sure you'll know, one of our finest nature poets, and she's recently translated a poem of Tagore's into English.
This is her version of a poem called Kapai, read by our former Delhi correspondent Randeep Ramesh, who then joined her in a discussion with Sarah.
Far away under a different sky, the Padma is wandering. Her left side is sandbanks, rootless, moodless, bold in their bareness. Her right side is heavy with groves, bamboos and mangoes, old bunions and tumble-down houses, crooked jack trees with fat trunks, a field of mustard by a pond. There are low jungles of reeds and indigo factories with no roof or walls, tall casuarinas rustling in the gardens night and day. And there's the village of the Raj Bangshis, where goats graze on cracked fields, and a granary with a tin roof in the market. People stand there looking tense and strained, with one eye always on the river. This is the Padma, the otherworldly river. This is the Mandakini, the river of songs. She is free of us, she passes by, she endures our towns but never looks at them. She is the mountain's voice, the granite poem being carried word perfect to the sea.
I was so pleased to see the article was doing justice to Tagore, and I was so outraged by the end of it, because I completely agree that poetry in translation is problematic, if not impossible. But actually, poetry always starts with impossibility. And I think to say it's impossible is a starting point rather than a point of surrender. And certainly with Tagore, it is worth just dismantling that impossibility. So I've done a translation of a translation.
I see. Okay, so that's your two removes, aren't you, from the original text. And what relationship then do the words that you've produced have to Tagore's original words?
Well, probably at this point, they are quite removed, but I have a great trust that if you open your mind properly to another writer, even a writer in another language, something, if you read enough around the subject, if you speak, in fact, to enough people who do speak Bengali, something will come across. And I think it's important anyway, when you're translating, to fix on the liveliness of the poem rather than all the sort of twists and turns of the style. So I hope that I've found what I find lively about Tagore and put it into my own words.
The poem that you've translated, it's about a river, the River Padma. And anyone who knows your work will know that rivers are a rich source of inspiration for you. The poem that you've produced, do you see it as your poem or do you see it as his?
I see it very much as Tagore's poem, and that I've learnt something from it. But I suppose my own experience of rivers and my love of rivers has made me feel able to join in with Tagore in his celebration of that river.
So it's a conversation then?
Yeah, I think so.
And Randeep, if I can bring you in now, looking at the poem that I have in front of me, there are lots of names and nouns and references that don't mean a great deal to me. Padma, the River Padma, I'm not familiar with, Mandakini. Ian Jack's point was that unless you know Bengali, you can't really appreciate the intricacies of Tagore. Do you think that these references to things that we don't really know about, does that stand in the way of us being able to appreciate the poem fully?
I think it probably does in some respect. I think what Alice is talking about is what's gained in translation. What I'm probably talking about is what's lost in translation. And that's the matrix of understanding that people have when they are embedded in a culture. And it's very clear that that exists wherever you live. Tagore lived in Bengal, but he was an Indian nationalist. And that culture that pervaded Indian nationalism, it didn't use the same words in the same ways that we did. There are very definite ways of saying things on the Indian subcontinent that are literally untranslatable. There are idiomatic expressions in Hindi that don't really make any sense in English. My favourite is, literally translates as, what's the difference between 19 and 20, which doesn't mean anything in English. But what it's supposed to be used as is, there isn't a lot in it, which are kind of, you can see where that comes from. But it's those kind of phrases that I think are very difficult to translate, and that's what you miss. I mean, in prose you can see it. Dostoevsky, and the characters in Crime and Punishment, a bit like Dickens, the names mean something. Raskolnikov is a sort of madness. Mm. So in some respects there are always, and maybe they're just insider jokes, that get lost in translation.
So Alice, that's a good point, isn't it? The difference between translating poetry and prose is quite, there's a big gulf between those two activities. Do you find translating poetry a more difficult act?
Well, actually, one of the things that drew me to this poem was that I happened to read that this was a poem in which he was experimenting with bringing something of his prose into his poetry, and that he kind of used the difference between those two rivers as a way of exploring the difference between prose and poetry. So I felt, okay, at least I don't have to grapple with a form that's completely alien to me. I mean, to me, I'm no good at prose, so I love the challenge of trying to lift poetry into another language. I've spent a lot of time trying to translate Homer, where I do actually speak the language of ancient Greek. And in that case, I really immersed myself in the form for so long that I felt I could then do something similar in modern English. I'm certainly nowhere near that stage with Tagore, but I believe it's possible. I used to live there, anchored on her sandbanks, away from everything, piercingly alone. Seen only by a star, I would rise at dawn and at night sleep on deck under the staring eyes of the plough. All day and night, she washed the edges of my mind, not noticing my intricate thinking. Like a tourist walks past a window, close to someone crying there, and yet far. But at middle age, I came to this dry plain, where shadowy villages make a line of bulging green. Another river is my neighbour here, unglamorous, ordinary Kopai. Her name is not Aryan, but from the sing-song language of Santal. She knows all her villages, moves among them, feeling their fields, and a man can easily shout from bank to bank. Hemp crops prickle her sides. Little rice seedlings green her shallows. Where the footpath stops, she gives way to the walker, letting him step through her strangeness. The fan palm waves from the plain, and mangoes, jams, amlokis rustle their approval.
Alice, can I just ask you, you're not a South Asian specialist, but could you just tell me what you thought the poem meant, and in particular the second verse?
I had already been drawn to be interested in Tagore's life on the River Padma early on, where he was basically being a rich man collecting rents from his tenants, living on this mighty, epic river, which speaks of its mountains, which just kind of ploughs through its people and reaches the sea. And then later in life, where he'd set up a school at Shantiniketan, it was a different landscape, it was a smaller river, and just as he'd kind of devoted his life to this practical worldly concern with a school and a university, so the river he was next to was small enough to make contact with its people. And his amazing image at the end of the people actually kind of crossing through the poem, he speaks of the river's sound as a poem, and the end of the poem is about the people crossing into the language and affecting the language.
And I think the point here is, for me, that the standout line is, her name is not Aryan. Mm. And in a sense that he renounces his Brahminical elite intellectualism to find a sort of earthier, more true visage of the Bengali landscape that he loves so much. I mean, in a sense, he sort of came down from the clouds and put his hands on people's feet and faces. And I think that's what you've done. You've sort of proved your point and disproved Ian's, if you like. Without speaking Bengali, you've essentially brought the essence of the poem to life.
It's always the case that every generation has to retranslate a poet. And I think that something Tagore can offer us is a really clever fusion of a worldly voice and a lyrical voice, a much more integrated way of binding the imagination into our political and social thinking.
She speaks the people's language. Nobody would call it literary. In her rickety rhythms, the earth rhymes with the water. Her thin body slips and swerves through sunlight and shadows, taking little steps in time with hand claps. And when it rains, she twists and sways like a tipsy village girl, but breaks nothing, drowns nothing, just flaps her spinning skirts and hurries laughing along, bumping the branches. Then after the rains, her streams come clear again, and you can see the sand through her skin. Oh, she is lovely in her tiredness. When she's rich, she's bashful. When she's poor, she's thankful, but beautiful in all her beings. Like when a woman dances, jingling her bangles, then sits down breathless with a laziness in her look and her lips loosened in a half smile. The kopai has mixed her rhythms into mine and given me this homespun hold-all poem. Her language is a crossing place. It is lyrical, practical, magical, ordinary. A boy can step through it, carrying his bow, or a bullet cart clatter over, stacked with straw, or a potter with his cheap pot swinging from a pole can plod across to market with a village dog rushing at his heels. And 3 minutes later, the head bowed 3-rupee teacher tiptoeing out under a torn umbrella.
Randy Ramesh reading Kopai by Tagore in a translation by Alice Oswald. Phew, I'm now going to have to go away and do some serious thinking about all the issues raised in this podcast. But to refresh our memory of all the things we've talked about, here's our audio montage of some of your very favourite essay quotations, as recommended to us on Twitter.
Every man being conscious to himself that he thinks, and that which his mind is applied about whilst thinking, being the ideas that are there, it is past doubt that men have in their minds several ideas, such as are those expressed by the words whiteness, hardness, sweetness, thinking, motion, man, elephant, army, drunkenness, and others. It is in the first place then to be inquired how he comes by them. John Locke.
It is a Sunday afternoon, preferably before the war. The wife is already asleep in the armchair and the children have been sent out for a nice long walk. You put your feet up on the sofa, settle your spectacles on your nose, and open the news of the world. Roast beef and Yorkshire, or roast pork and apple sauce, followed up by suet pudding and driven home, as it were, by a cup of mahogany brown tea, have put you in just the right mood. Your pipe is drawing sweetly, the sofa cushions are soft underneath you, the fire is well alight, the air is warm and stagnant. In these blissful circumstances, what is it that you want to read about? Naturally, about a murder. But what kind of murder? George Orwell.
Men, they further observe, submit everywhere to oppression, when they have only to lift up their heads to throw off the yoke. Yet instead of asserting their birthright, they quietly lick the dust and say, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Mary Wollstonecraft.
In a graduate workshop I briefly passed through, a certain grey eminence tried to convince us that a literary story should always eschew any feature which serves to date it, because serious fiction must be timeless. When we protested that, in his own well-known work, characters moved about electrically lit rooms, drove cars, and spoke not Anglo-Saxon but post-war English, and further, that fiction he'd himself ratified as great, such as Dickens, was liberally strewn with innately topical, commercial, and time-bound references, he impatiently amended his prescription to those explicit references that would date a story in the frivolous now. Jonathan Lethem.
It hath been an opinion that the French are wiser than they seem, and the Spaniards seem wiser than they are. Francis Bacon.
In a sense, the first, if not necessarily the prime function of a novelist, of any artist, is to entertain. If the poem, painting, play or novel doesn't immediately engage one's surface interest, then it's failed. Whatever else it may or may not be, art is also entertainment. Bad art fails to entertain. Good art does something in addition. Bridget Brophy.
May you all go forth happily to rediscover the essay then. Sarah, what else do we have on offer this week?
Well, I, for one, will certainly be going to the review on Saturday to find out in full what Carmen Khalil has to say for herself on the Roth controversy. Plus, on Saturday, we have John Fuller on Solving the Puzzles of Poetry. And on Sunday, in the Observer's new review, Melvin Bragg reviews the posthumous novel from Beryl Bainbridge, The Girl in the Polka Dot Dress. And if you missed our feature about her life as a painter, you can still read it on the website guardian.co.uk/books.
So do keep spreading the word about our podcast, where every week you can hear many interesting voices talking about books. Do subscribe as well at guardian.co.uk/books or via iTunes. On Tuesday, we'll be launching our fascinating book club session with Mohsin Hamid, author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist. And next week, we'll discuss your recommendations on the best in science fiction. If you haven't yet left your tips, please do so on the website. And that's all for now. Thanks to Lucaster Miller, Ian Finlayson, Alice Oswald and Randeep Ramesh. From me, Claire Armistead, Sarah Crown and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.